pleased indeed to welcome Bjarne Olsen from the University of Aarhus in Denmark. He's doing work on the Shakta traditions, and it's really interesting work because he's a Sanskritist. He's got a degree in Sanskrit, but he's also very interested in issues within the study of religions and a sort of macro-cultural questions, if you like. So how do we map the particularity of the text that we in Sanskrit with bigger questions and bigger issues in the study of religion and culture and in the study of the history of traditions? So today he's going to talk about the origins and development of Shaktism and relate some of the textual detail that he's been reading with sort of meta-theoretical questions, if you like, or questions about the long duration in history and so on, I think. So I'll pass it over to you, Bjarne. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the invitation. No? And for this opportunity to share some thoughts with you. I think I will have to start with saying that this is my first PowerPoint show ever, so I'm a bit excited about this this new development in my presentation. And I got one of these laser pens too, which I will try to apply to this. And I will have to probably to warn you also that the focus of this presentation will be quite broad, and it relates to the nature of my thesis, which is actually a claim of definition, trying to establish what is Shaktism, this tradition, which is on a conventional level usually agreed upon that it's one of the three major Hindu traditions. But as we see on an analytical level, there's still much confusion as to definitions, classifications, and so on, and also in relation to the establishing the textual traditions, and so on. So my overall point with this presentation would be this, that the discussion of definition and classification of Shaktism will alter not only how we study Shaktism, but also what we understand it to be. Like the terms Shaivism and Vaishnavism, we'll see that Shaktism is a category created out of the scholarly imagination, designed to represent to us a distinctive type of Indian religious tradition. But this is not to reduce Shaktism to a scholarly fiction. I would claim that our aim would be to consider it from the perspective of the historian of religion rather than from the standpoint of the Shakta theologian. And what I propose is that we must identify the distinctive Shakta worldview from a critical, perhaps external point of view, but not necessarily like to emphasize the critical, analytical point of view. And also probe critically what Shaktas say about themselves and attempt to explain why they say it, and in this way also trying to reveal and understand something of the Shakta religious imaginaire. And I have a German background, so I'm quite fond of the generalizations, the definitions, the models, classifications, taxonomies, and so on. And also I think they should be intersubjectively shareable and theoretically informed so that they can assist us in the production of rational critical evidence, you could express it like this. So it is a claim of definition I'm trying to elaborate on, which if time allows it, I would like to reply to an area of confusion, which would be the Shakta tantric traditions. my approach, my theoretical basis is that of worldview analysis and a mythology which would be Motiv- und Begriffsgeschichte. I think it's called something like motive historical approach in English, synchronic, diachronic, to representative Schachter texts, also trying to link it with art historical and ethnographic material. So, firstly, I will address Schachtism as a somewhat neglected area of research and the problem of definition. There is on the conventional level the agreement that it is one of the three main traditions, and as Gavin points out here, research on the Schaeffer traditions has been quite extensively developed in recent years, but we're still lacking a sustained research program that requires into the history, doctrine and practices, and also art history of what might be called Schachtism. It is still a desideratum. And as has been pointed out by David Kinsley, a study of the Indian goddesses is actually a study of the Hindu tradition itself. You can come across all the phenomena, all the most important phenomena related to Hindu religiosity. And to cite Gavin again, it is actually not possible to study Hinduism adequately without an understanding of Devi and the Shakta traditions, because the goddess pervades Hinduism at all levels, from anecholic village deities to high caste pan-Hindu goddesses. And of course the region of influence can be graphically shown like this. It is much the same area as is influenced by Tantrism, and of course by Tantric Buddhism. And I think it's a very good map, this one. I'm very happy to have found this from the Center for Tantric Studies at the University of Hamburg. But still you come across statements like these, that there are numerous works on different aspects of the cult of the female principle, but virtually nothing has as yet been written comprehensively on the history and historical role of the Shakta religion. It is still very much the case. There's only been a few Western and Indian scholars doing these kind of broad studies. And to come to the reason why this is the situation, we would have to look a bit on the history of research of Shaktism. Traditionally, Shaktism and Tantrism was very much taken as synonyms, and because of the association with Tantrism, it was considered something like a worthless subject. This is a quotation from a Danish professor. I wrote my bachelor project on Shaktism, and it was considered of the highest notes, but also the statement that it was a worthless subject and on the periphery of Indology, not actually an area which an Indologist should look at. It's more something for tourists and hippies and travelers and so on. If we look on the research history, it was from the beginning by researchers like Wilson, Monier Williams, Farquhar, Vinternitz and so on, associated with tanzprisen, but there were also scholars like Helmut von Glasenapp especially, who separated tanzprisen from Schachtism, stated that Christine von Hausau was verschiedene Dinge. But it took a long time before this was recognized, and it's still very much the case. I will show some examples of this. In the recent decades, the research has been somehow divided between the Indian approach and the Western approach. The Western would be the Canadian, European, American approach, which looks at particular practices, gender studies, discussions about sexuality and feminism and so on, detailed field studies, while Indians write some of the broad histories, historical surveys and the history of art and philosophy, of course. And besides the difference between the university systems and the way of writing theses, it seems that it is because it's quite a new subject in the West that we are still doing particular studies, not daring the broad, the macro studies, but they're becoming more and more important, these broad studies, to place the particular studies in the right context, to get the proportions right, and to put it into context and perspective. And my point would be that besides that scholars have been quite reluctant to consider the possibility of Shaktism's very pervasive and influential role in Indian religious history for what appear to be personal, ethical and emotional reasons, it is also very much the problem of definition that is the reason. And it is very well summed up here by Brockington. There is in most scholarship the tendency to view Shaktism as a branch of Shaivism, as feminized Shaivism, I think the term coined by Sanderson, and to view tantric Shaktism as a mere subject of tantric Shaivism. And as I've already mentioned, Shaktism and tantrism are still taken to be synonyms, and I think that this problem of definition may also to some extent be due to the use of indigenous Shaiva classifications in relation to defining Shaktism by modern scholarship. I will return to this point. Firstly, there's the classical model, the Hindu Trimurti, what is considered to be the high gods, the high goddesses. And this is a classical example. This is from, it's actually a new publication by Axel Michaels from Hamburg, from Heidelberg, giving an overview of the epic Puranic pantheon. We will see Brahma, Vishnu and Shiva as the main gods, and we will find Devi, not with a capital D, but somewhere down the list of other names or manifestations, you will find Shakti. And this is still the classical view of what I consider the main gods. I'll just draw a little overview. thing that the classical model for engagement is in this chance for many places for generation. Brahman is all one part. Then we have Brahmas, we got the main point about him. And we in the identification of the teacher. Actually, the piece is that it's already known that the few sentences of Brahman is a typical creature block in the four theistic answer of his Deus Vitiosus, who recalls after creating the world, God in creation, while Vishnu and Shiva and another goddess actually considered to be cosmic qualities, who each possesses the abilities to create, preserve and destroy the world, also to dilute and to save. That is not the case in relation to Brahma. So that would be the twist to it. It's been taught. And it is an important point to shift the focus slightly to see the goddess also as one of the cosmic deities, as one of the high gods. So I believe that Devi should be highlighted also in this overview. And then there's the confusion between Vaishnavism, Shaivism and Shaktism, if they can be said to be separate traditions or one stream of traditions. This Shaivism, Shaktism, Tantrism point as one mainstream. I think it's Annette Wilke who makes this point. And here's still the classical example is from Jan Gondar, the religion Indians, where we'll find the Vishnuismus, the Shivaismus, and up here we'll find Tantrism and Shaktism as subordinated. And here we have an example again from Axel Mikael's books, Trends of Shaivism, Tantrism and Shaktism, where we will find under the headline of the sectarian Shaivism, we will find Tantric Shaktism down here as a subset of Shaktism, where we have the two main traditions, Vaishnavism and Shaivism, and then a small subset called Shaktism. I came across the new Oxford Dictionary of Hinduism, and I don't remember the author, but it was interestingly stated that Shaktism is considered one of the three major Hindu traditions, and there was, I think, seven lines about Shaktism. And when you looked up the two other main traditions, Vaishnavism and Shaivism, you would get a whole page for each of these traditions. So this is the unbalanced approach. And I would like to suggest classification, something like this. There's a fusion between it's inspired by Gavin Flood's approach and Axel Mikael's, and I added some traditions, major Hindu traditions, as well as Smartism, the three main traditions here. And if you give an overview like this, it would be possible to separate at first Tantric ritualism and Tantrism as a form of spiritualism. You will have three Hindu religions and four forms of Hindu religiosity, but modes of religious activity. corresponding. So you will be able to at first separate tantrism as a mode of religiosity, something like perhaps like technical religiosity, or a sub-universe of meaning, to use a term from the worldview analysis. And then you will have the overall coherent worldviews. These sub-universes of meaning, they can go across traditions and forms of religions. But these major traditions would be worldviews that are coherent and can be separated and defined. Up here you will have what you can call the three Brahmanical systems in the form of the four great theistic pan-Hindu traditions. And they can be said to be religions in their own right, but still within the general category of Hinduism. And they fit somehow to our better, at least to our Western Christian-inspired, more static understanding of religion. And they are sometimes treated like this with their own doctrines, worldviews, social institutions, rituals, and of course authoritative scriptures. But what you see is then either description of this as Shaktism, as epic Quranic Shaktism, and then the Shakti Tantra traditions. But there's also a very important popular Shaktism. So to unite these into one definition will be the challenge. The tantric Shaktism can be seen as two overlapping but not coinciding circles. And what is common to these, the Shakti tantrism is seen as both Shaktism par excellence and tantrism par excellence, and that is why it is often taken as synonyms. And this is also what is a bit misleading, because tantrism is part of this much broader tradition. You have the interplay between the great and the small tradition here, and between the tantric traditions and the popular traditions here. You can further see the interplay between the Kali Kula and the Sri Kula. The Kali Kula is more related to the folk traditions, between the folk traditions and the tantric traditions, while the Sri Kula is more related to the Brahmanical religions. And what you will see in this perspective is that there's a correspondence between the rise of the goddess in the Brahmanical systems that corresponds to the rise of the goddess in the renounced traditions, and as shown also in relation to the rise of the goddess in esoteric Buddhism. Yes, that was my suggestion for an overview. So maybe a bit, make it a bit more clear. This would be our main area of confusion then. The overlapping of Shaivism and Shaktism. And it looks something like this. This is a tentative stemmer to show the overlap, and we probably recognize Sanderson's classification of the Shaiva tantric traditions with this. I'm sorry that it is a Danish overview, but you probably understand the Sanskrit terms. So we have the overlap here of the Kaula traditions, the Kali Kula, the Sri Kula, the Asaidantika, and the Shakta Tantras here, when Shaktism is described and Shaivism is described, these traditions will be described in both cases. And one model is to see it as a development within Shaivism towards a feminized Shaivism, which has then influenced Buddhism. But another model would be to look on Shaktism as an independent tradition rooted in a very old Shakta milieu, Bhutto milieu, which has influenced both Shaivism and Buddhism, so a separate milieu. That is a point made by Jeffrey Samuels in his new book, The Origins of Yoga and Tantra. His point is summarized in this quotation in relation to these Shaiva Tantric traditions, that if Sanderson is right in arguing that the Yogini Tantras represent a Buddhist appropriation of Shaiva Tantra, how did this take place? One can ask how far this is really an adaptation of Shaiva Tantra. For both Buddhist and Shaiva Tantra, the rise to primacy of female divinities and the sexual yogas seem to have been a new development. These developments seem to have taken place more or less at the same time among Buddhists and among Shaivas, and borrowings have been traced in both directions. So the female divinities may well best be understood in terms of a distinct Shakta milieu from which both Shaivas and Buddhists were borrowing. And certainly the historical relationship between Shakta and Shaiva practices is far from clear. And he is basing this very much on a manuscript by Thomas Hopkins, which is not yet published. I've been communicating with Thomas Hopkins and he promised to send me a revised edition, but he's still working on it. I'm looking very much forward to see it. So this is a summary from Samuel's book on what is described in more detail in Thomas Hopkins' manuscript. And the basic idea is that we have the Kuru Panchala culture here and the central Gangetic region culture here, two models, two cultural patterns or worlds. This will be the Aryan Brahmanical Vedic world. But the obvious question is what was happening in the rest of India at that time. And we would find here the non-Aryan Buddhist Jain world. We find the proto-Sramana cults, the wisdom-oriented traditions and earth-centered rituals of fertility and prosperity. We find the Yaksha or Yakshi religion, which is a Laukika of nature. It's focused on auspiciousness and fertility. And we have more material in relation to the Yakshi cult than the Indus Valley culture. So this gives us a better grounding for talking about the regions of Shaktism than the speculation about earlier mother goddess cults in the Indus culture, Kuli culture, or Soap cultures, and so on. So we would find in this central Gangetic region and the northern Deccan a world of female powers, natural transformation, sacred places, blood sacrifices, and ritualists who accept pollution on behalf of the community, and so on. And we would have actually sources like the Ramayana and the extensive iconographical evidence to describe this world. It can be seen as the background for a pan-Indian religious substrate of some kind. Also the region of the fierce goddesses, the Shaktipithas, and there's goddesses that are at a later point of time related to the Kapalika style of Shaivas. The critique of this broadly outlined hypothesis is that there's no direct textual evidence for such a non-affiliated religious system, which is pointed out by Sanderson and Donaldson. Nevertheless, the local goddess cults seems to be a near certainty. Then I will not go actually much into the development of Shaktism, just the broad outline that it's of course a long and complicated process, which can be summarized very shortly in two phases where non-Aryan local goddesses with possible roots in the Indus Valley culture and also in this central Gangetic region are upgraded and assimilated in the Brahmanical pantheon by being identified to the male Indo-Aryan gods consorts by domestication, Sanskritization. And these fierce goddesses, as they are mentioned by, or called by O'Flaherty, the goddesses of truth, they will reach a higher and higher degree of independence, probably promoted by tantric and shaktic movements outside the Brahmanical worlds, which have been there for many centuries. At last being united with the mild Brahmanical goddesses of breast, the Saumya goddesses, in the figure of the great goddess Devi, which is superior to the male goddesses. I'm translating from Danish, so that's why it's maybe not that fluent. It is culminating in the Digma Hadmir text, of course, in the like the 5th or 6th century. This is the first text where Shaktism is really established, where Devi is established as one of the cosmic high gods or goddesses, with the three cosmic functions of creating, maintaining, and destroying the world. She can be seen as the whole that is greater than the sum of its parts. A locus classicus of the text is where the teachers, the potences of the male gods are united in one figure, this very beautiful woman, Devi, who is more powerful than all the male gods, and she can actually defeat the demon Mahisha. Her fight with the buffalo demon Mahisha that has become the main iconographical representation of Durga as Devi Mahishasura Mardini. But when Western researchers study the goddess, they will normally, as first pointed out, not study Shaktism as such. It's mostly left to Indians to do the broad studies, and especially Indians from Bengal like Bhattacharya. Western scholars would do particular studies of one goddess. They would reduce her to one or two of her aspects, show a preference for textual sources often a single group of texts, just a single text, and for field observations, especially festivals, as pointed out by Axel Michaels. And Western researchers would usually focus on the history, the historical origins of this one goddess, and mostly leaving out the question about identity or definition of this one goddess or this particular local goddess tradition. But we know very little of the origins, and we lack verifiable data. And this is, of course, why one is tempted to hypothesize an old Ketonic origin, which is often highly problematic and nevertheless very, very fascinating. But if we look on the question of identity, it is very tricky, especially tricky in relation to the goddesses. They seem to be much harder to define than male deities. And one example of classification is this. There are many ways of approaching the goddesses. This would be an overall functional classification founded at an exhibition by the Artuam Sattler Gallery, David the Great Goddess, in 1999, classifying the aspects of Devi into cosmic force, Daini, Erin, Loki protector, semi-divine force, and women, saints. And in relation to Shaktism, Shaktism proper is of course Devi as a cosmic force that is important. This is where we find goddesses who have been raised to the status of the absolute Shakti, such as Kali, Durga, Lalita, and so on. That is to the usually male status of the supreme, limitless, transcendent, universal deity. These six aspects can be cut down to these two aspects, the goddesses of breasts, Saumya, the mild goddesses, and the goddesses of truth, Ukra, the wild goddesses. And this is the standard categorization, this dichotomous approach, which is then again united in one paradoxical nature of the great goddess Devi as two extremes, and she moves between these extremes. But again, as Axel Michaels has pointed out, we still need to explain why some deities, almost exclusively female, have multiple identities, and other deities do not. Mostly male deities are not both masculine and feminine, and not mostly do not both receive bloody and vegetarian offers, and so on. And an explanation of this problem, this is a good example, the Bhusheshwari, which unites all these contrasts. She's both Ukra and Saumya, tantric, non-tantric, God accepting, a pure vegetarian, so on. She has no clear identity and she remains a secret. A way of explaining this, which I find highly useful, is Axel Michaels' thesis about the identificatory habitus. It is one of the best explanations I have seen of why goddesses are allowed such an oceanic and unlimited identity, uniting all these what seems to be contrasting aspects. It can explain why Shaktism is so hard to define as well, as this identificatory habitus is at the heart of Shaktism, and it can also be said to be what is actually the genius of the tradition and could be said to be Hinduism par excellence, as this identificatory habitus is seen as something like the essence of Hinduism, actually, by Axel Mikaels. It is in stark contrast to a Western understanding of identity. It is a way of establishing an identity by equating it with something else. Normally in the West, an identity would be established by contrasting it to other things. Determinaturist negation, like Spinoza expressed it. But in an Indian context, you can see the something like the reverse thing going on, that an identity is actually established by identification, and the more something can be identified with, broadly speaking, the more strong is its identity. And this identificatory habitus, which is acquired in childhood, appears especially in relation to the goddesses. And this is a small point that Axel Mikaels makes, but he doesn't really elaborate on it, that they are powerful because they can be identified with nearly everything. He makes a point out of saying that it can be seen as an expression of the Hindu belief in the powerful experience of a primary, pre-verbal, pre-conscious reality, which has been described by Sudhir Kaka and Stanley Kurtz as an experience related to the Indian childhood experience of the mother. And this could actually explain why female deities tend to have such multiple identities, why they are allowed to have this. Perhaps some of you know the Hindi proverb "Sab Devi Ek Hi Hai," "Sab Ma Ek Hi Hai" is an example of this. So, if we should define Shaktism, it would be possible to take a starting point, a definition of Hinduism which includes the identificatory habitus. This is again Axel Mikaels' 5-point definition of Hinduism, and I would suggest that you would apply a prototype theory to this, where you have a category of Hinduism with fluid borders, and where these 5 points can be seen as something that defines something as degrees of prototypicality through the family resemblance. In relation to Shaktism, of course, the 4th point would be that it would be a manifestation of Devi worshipped as a goddess, a high goddess, Devi, or divine force, Shakti. And then I would suggest this way of classification. And a definition like this, distinguishing between independent Shaktism, Shaktism proper, or what you could call actually hardcore Shaktism, again from a point of view of prototype theory, and that Shaktism would be defined from its worldview oriented towards Shakti, and to a lesser degree in relation to its praxis. There seems to be also a conventional agreement that it is the worldview that is defining Shaktism, and I agree with this. This is inspired by many attempts by Helmut von Glasenapp, Gavin Flood, David Gordon White, and Jean Godrian, Coburn, and others to define Shaktism. I've tried to fuse them into this. One point is that in independent Shaktism, Shakti is not inseparably connected with an inactive subordinate male principle. You do have independent Shaktism, as the Devi Mahatmya text is an example of. But it is the case in Tantric Shaktism that Shakti is inseparably connected with an inactive subordinate male principle. This could also be used to explain one of the great forces of Shaktism, the ability to go cross-cultural, so to say, in a dependent form, and having the ability to pop up, for example, in Tibetan Buddhism, you have special contrary to Kroda Kali, where you would have to define it actually as Shaktism. To make a definition like this, which is a preliminary working definition, there should be an interplay between the scholars' understandings of common features of structuring principles seen from outside the tradition and Shakta self-understandings and its own categories for self-description. So the approach would be an external historical the approach of an externalist historical philological approach, which nevertheless takes indigenous claims about tradition to be important and valid. And I believe that there are important reasons, an important reason for the problem of definition, as earlier mentioned, is the uncritical use of indigenous cyber classifications by modern scholarship in relation to defining Shaktism. So this interplay would be very important. One other reason is that because of the of Shakta association with unorthodox tantric practices and non-Vedic or tribal cultures, some goddess worshippers and texts are sometimes hesitant to label themselves Shakta, and they practice their tradition in secret or under the guise of Shaivism. And as Bengali saying goes, I think it's from the Yoni Tantra, that one should be Vaishnava in public, Shaiva in private, and Shakta in secret. I would suggest that a definition from the view of an historian of religion might go against the self-understanding in texts. So I would propose that the use of the terms Shakta and Shaktism in a rather anachronistic way, as it is often used in modern scholarship, namely as denoting those who worship Shakti and the different aspects retrospectively considered as her manifestations, as well as the traditions which they follow, would be the right way of applying these terms. It would evoke a conception of an overarching and syncretic network of traditions uniting the three forms of religion, the Brahmanical, the folk tradition, and the ascetical traditions. And this would be, although it's sometimes a devotee of, for example, Kali in one of her many forms, who would be classified as a Shakta, would feel more like or prefer to be called a Shaiva. So it seems that it would be preferable to actually to go towards something like a hermeneutic of suspicion. In a way that where you would define the worldview of Shaktism from a critical external viewpoint, trying to to discover hidden motives, leading tendencies in text, you would be able to explain from a Shakta viewpoint, I think in a better way than from a Shaiva viewpoint, why some Shaivas are actually not worshipping Shiva, but a form of the goddess, why there is a tendency to esotericism, a radicalization of the system, the fierce goddesses, monism, the pitas, the identificatory habitus, why this is especially prevalent, the equation of Shakti and Brahman, the subordination or irrelevance of Bhairava, the main principle, and so on. I think that a definition from a critical Shakta perspective, relating to a framework of Shaktism, based on these classification and definitions, could throw light on an area of confusion. So we're going to stop here. Thank you for your patience.